You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up from Rhinelander's Hodag to Elkhorn's Beast of Bray Road, Wisconsin has a lot of mysterious legends. We'll talk with a local author about his hunt for the strangest stuff the Midwest has to offer. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Earlier this week, there was a big drug bust in the Appleton area involving large amounts of methamphetamine. Doug Schneider has been covering that story for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's a watchdog reporter there based in Green Bay. Doug, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, always happy to be on WPR. Thanks for having me.
Well, Doug, give us a sense of the scale of this meth bust.
Well, the big headline is that there were nearly 60 pounds of methamphetamine in suitcases in a hotel room in Grand Chute outside of Appleton. A federal grand jury has indicted 9 people from northeastern Wisconsin alleging that they were part of a conspiracy to distribute meth up here and have been involved in this conspiracy now for 4 months at least.
And if I'm doing the math right from your piece, this is probably hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of meth, this 60 pounds?
Correct. It depends on whether it's sold on the street or wholesale, but authorities are telling us we're talking about $500,000 to three-quarters of $1 million in value.
And 60 pounds of some things isn't a lot, but this is often sold, it sounds like, by the gram. So this would be a lot of meth on the streets.
It certainly would be.
So what more have police been saying about the investigation and what might come next?
There haven't been a ton of details because the defendants they've made brief court appearances, but prosecutors haven't put their cards on the table yet. Essentially, we know that there were at least 3 people who were arrested who had drugs, cash, and firearms, and that police have seized at least $65,000 from 2 of those guys, and they allege that they were the proceeds of drug sales or involved in drug distribution.
And, Doug, we hear a lot about the opioid epidemic. I talked to a sheriff from northwestern Wisconsin, a Polk County, not that long ago, saying meth was a big problem in their part of the state. Before this arrest, has there been a lot of awareness that meth is a big problem in the Fox Valley?
There have been indications of it. It seems like whenever authorities start tamping down one type of drug, another one tends to pop up. And I know there's been some fear with opioids that people who think they're getting and using heroin may end up with fentanyl and never wake up again. So there's some talk that that's been an opportunity for people who deal other substances to fill a little bit of a niche in the drug market.
Doug, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Have a good day.
That's Doug Schneider, watchdog reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Green Bay. We talked to him about a large meth bust in the Appleton area. Next, there's some concern from state agencies and local groups around a proposed natural gas plant in northern Wisconsin. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob.
Give us a sense of the scope of this power plant in the Superior area.
Oh, it's a huge project. It would cost around $700 million once this natural gas facility is built. And basically, that's the biggest project that Douglas County has ever seen. They're talking about a $1 billion investment in the area over the next 20 years. And it would create, you know, a few hundred construction jobs and about $1 million each year in local tax revenues.
And there's a concern about groundwater here. When I heard that, I thought, oh, it's pollution from the plant. No, apparently a natural gas plant like this uses a lot of groundwater. What's going on?
Yeah, so they are proposing to drill 5 high-cap wells just by the Nemadji River. And they want to pump up to 5.4 million gallons per day. And that would be used for cooling of the generating facility. On average, it would probably be more around 3 million that they would be pumping. But state regulators have raised concerns that maybe there's not enough water there to meet their needs.
Right. That's some of the newest news you've reported on. What are we hearing from state departments that have looked into this water usage request?
Yeah. So staff with the DNR, including hydrogeologists and others in the water section, are looking at this proposal and they're going over, you know, what the aquifer in the area can handle. And so they've been looking at well construction reports and other information, including pumping tests that have been done in that area in the past. And what they found is that basically, because of the geology of the site, it may not be as productive for water as the company thinks. They think the aquifer can't handle the amount of water that they want to pump for this project.
You write there have also been concerns raised by the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. What are their concerns about this project?
Oh, there are many. They're concerned about the impact to wetlands. They're concerned about placing a power plant on, you know, so close to the Nemadji River when this area has seen 500-year floods in recent history. They don't think that's wise. They're worried about the water usage. They're worried that, you know, archaeological aspects of, you know, looking into the Native American impacts there haven't been fully examined. So they have a number of concerns.
And what's the argument from the utility company about the need for this plant?
Well, they're saying that this is essential for them to be able to transition away from coal-fired power plants and coal-fired generation because they're planning to use this natural gas facility to back up wind and solar that they're drawing from right now. In fact, Minnesota Power is working towards a goal of providing 50% of its power from renewable sources by 2021. Dairyland Power, which is also a partner in the project, hasn't set an exact goal, but they've been talking about maybe working towards 25% renewable energy by 2025. And they say that this is needed so they can make that transition, so they can get there.
What's the next step in this project?
So the next step in the project is they're still going through the permitting process. There have been no approvals made for, approval for the high cap wells that they need or this water use permit. And there are really like more than a dozen permits that they need to be able to do this project. And the PSC is still hearing testimony, and there will be public hearings later this month at the end of October.
Danny, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior. We talked to her about proposals for a natural gas plant in Superior. Finally, a variety of organizations and communities in Milwaukee are teaming up to confront the problem of infant mortality. Corrine Hess is a WPR reporter in Milwaukee. Corey, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob.
Can you give us a sense of how big a problem this is in Milwaukee?
It is a problem. About 1 in 10 babies are born prematurely, and I would say about 1 in 100 of those babies die every year.
And what are some of the causes people are trying to deal with?
You know, infant mortality is a really complex problem. It's related to a lot of issues, poverty, race, and health disparities. So, you know, for years, the city and other people in the city have been, the city officials and other, you know, healthcare providers have just been trying to get their arms around this.
Who are some of the community groups and others working together to try to get a handle on this issue?
Well, the hospitals started a program called Blanket of Love, and that was trying to connect pregnant women and new mothers with services that they might not know about or be thinking about. And then the city got involved in 2015, and they've just been trying to keep this going. So this week, they met with church leaders just to try to get everybody on board. You know, I think they believe that pastors and clergy members have tight relationships with people in the community, and maybe they can spread the message.
You write that some congregations have been doing this for a while with something called a strong baby Sabbath. What is that?
Well, that's where one Sunday in October every year, they try to really focus on things like making sure that women in the communities know that they're not alone and that there is health care available to them and that if they need help, they can get it, you know, either through the church or through the different health care programs in the community.
I know it's an ongoing effort. Corey, is there any sign that this kind of work is having an impact?
You know, I think it is having some impact, and I think that the more there is focus placed on this, it is starting to help.
Corey, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That's Corrine Hess, WPR reporter in Milwaukee. We talked to her today about groups working to tackle the problem of infant mortality in the city. She finishes up our weekly roundup of stories from around the state. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin author who went hunting for some of the Midwest's most famous monsters, aliens, and local legends. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about a string of recent court rulings that some First Amendment advocates say are a troubling sign for the media. Right now, whether it's the Hodag in Rhinelander or an alien encounter in Eagle River, a lot of towns in Wisconsin and the Midwest in general have stories of strange happenings that people talk about to this day. Our next guest spent a year traveling the Midwest in search of these local legends. He found out that even if you can't get the answers you're looking for, there's a lot of value in just trying to find out. B.J. Hollers is an associate professor of English at UW-Eau Claire and the author of Midwestern Strange, Hunting Monsters, Martians, and the Weird in Flyover Country. B.J., welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Well, I skipped your most important credential, B.J. You founded the Indiana Monster Research Center, you write, when you were 8 years old.
Well, I didn't want to brag. We did have our funding cut pretty quickly. My mom immediately decided she needed the phone line back. So it was born in a closet in my childhood home. And then about 2 days in, we didn't get any calls. And so my mom took the phone, and that was the end of that chapter.
But it started a long fascination with stories of weird stuff, kind of on the fringes of what we know and don't know.
Absolutely. You know, there were a couple kind of key moments, I suppose, in my childhood that really got me hooked into this world. One was a crop circle that occurred in Paulding, Ohio in 1996, about 45 minutes from my hometown in Indiana. And my brother and I persuaded my mom to drive us there. And we saw this crop circle with our very own eyes. It wasn't on an X-Files episode. It was right here in a field. And that was sort of a moment when I started to think maybe we should look a little deeper into what's going on right here in our backyards.
Now, you did something unusual for an English professor. I think you spent a year, in effect, as an investigator of stories of weird legends, weird legendary creatures. You didn't set out to prove or debunk these stories. You just went on the hunt. What led you to want to do that?
You know, it was a lot of things. But part of the motivation was kind of the aftermath of the 2016 election. Folks were talking about fake news and post-truth era. And so I began to ask myself about why was it that our critical thinking skills seemed to have been lessened or weakened in some ways. And so I thought by asking folks about these strangest things that often aren't based in much factual evidence and why folks believe in these stories, maybe we might learn a little more about why we believe in broader topics that sometimes lack the facts.
Before we dig into some of the particular stories you chased, what was your method? What did you set out to try to do?
You know, so much about what I like to do is to hit the road, to knock on the door, to talk to the stranger, and to let folks speak for themselves. And so there was plenty of armchair research along the way, and I looked at every written record and document I could get my hands on. But so much about this was earning the trust of people in small towns throughout the Midwest and letting them know that this was an opportunity for them to tell their own story, to tell their own strangeness, and then learn how these small towns approached these odd stories and what they did with them.
You tackle a bunch of cases. I want to focus in on at least a couple of the Wisconsin ones. And let's start with, this is kind of a well-known one, I think, the Beast of Bray Road in Elkhorn. One witness called it one of God's mistakes. First, give us the basic details of this legend.
Absolutely. Well, in the fall of 1989, a woman named Lori Andreese was driving home after a long shift at her job, and around 1:30 in the morning, she looked off to the right of Bray Road in Elkhorn, and she saw this brownish-gray-furred wolf-like creature kind of crouched on its knees, eating what appeared to be roadkill. And so this was only the first of many sightings to come. Every couple years, and certainly back in 89-90, there was a rash of sightings, but there would be this bipedal wolf that people were seeing that was apparently running down Bray Road and chasing after cars and really putting people, keeping people on their toes, so to speak.
And what kind of things did you do to try to investigate the Beast of Bray Road?
Well, I spent some time in Elkhorn, of course, and I spent a lot of time talking to kind of the local and world expert on it, Linda Godfrey. She was a journalist for the Elkhorn Weekly Paper back in 1989. Suddenly, she wrote one story about this alleged Beast of Bray Road, and since she has really made a career in investigating this and other strange phenomena. So we spent some time kind of going up and down Bray Road, but we also spent some time just talking about sort of the risks inherent when folks like us try to even engage in topics that are so strange to the general public.
Like what kind of risks?
Well, I think there are probably professional risks. And so I have to be very mindful as a professor. You know, I'm here to investigate, to explore, but not so much to make any rulings on these sorts of things. But I think as Linda says, too, you know, the real risks are to the people who come out and talk to me to begin with. You know, I think oftentimes people, I mean, I guess the question is, when was the last time we were at our water coolers at work? And when people asked us how our weekends were, we said it was great. I watched the Packers. I saw a UFO. No one says that second part, you know, and there's a reason for that. So kind of looking deeper at why people feel so kind of tight-lipped about sharing these stories.
Now, people shared their own stories and, you know, they may have seen something, we don't know. But then there was a video that turned, I think this is the story where there was a video that turned out to really not be on the level at all.
It was not. There was a video clip that emerged. Allegedly, the footage was taken in the 70s, and it was kind of in this old reel-to-reel. And so it's really astonishing to watch from just kind of a Hollywood perspective. This person did a fine job of fabricating this footage, and I've showed it to my students, and we kind of go through it frame by frame. But in fact, no, it was not, in fact, the Beast of Bray Road. It was still fun to watch, still pretty eerie and pretty creepy, but it's just one more facet to the stories. You know, there are folks out there who are attempting to hoax or do what they can to get a little attention. But the beauty of this, too, is that most of the folks I talked to were very sincere about what they had seen. And in fact, were often very hesitant to speak at all on the record.
Talking to BJ Hollers, Associate Professor of English at UW-Eau Claire, author of the book Midwestern Strange, Hunting Monsters, Martians, and the Weird in Flyover Country. Another of the Wisconsin stories you share, I don't think I'd seen this one before, Joe Simonton's Space Pancakes in Eagle River. Tell us about this incident.
One of my personal favorites. So in April of 1961, a man named Joe Simonton out of Eagle River was washing his dishes one morning, and allegedly a spaceship, a flying saucer of sorts, landed in his backyard. Some aliens stepped out. He described them as looking like, quote, Italians. Not sure what that means, but these aliens stepped out and they handed him a vessel. Apparently they needed some water, so he got them some water, handed it back. And in exchange for the water, one of the aliens handed him four space pancakes. So pancake-like looking food. And so what do you do when someone hands you a pancake from outer space? You got to try it out. You didn't want to be rude. So he ate it, which was pretty odd. And then the story gets stranger still because the Air Force intervenes. They commandeered the remainder of these pancakes. They did some testing. Food and Drug Administration gets involved. And perhaps one of my favorite findings of the whole book is that after all the tests, it is determined that these pancakes were, in fact, of terrestrial origin. So maybe they weren't from outer space after all.
I love this story because it has two of the most, like, you think people will have these really outlandish details about their alien encounter. And in this one, the aliens look like they're Italians and they give him pancakes.
It's so grounded in our world in so many ways. It really is silly. Another kind of silly facet to this story is when Joe Simonton finally got the floor to speak, he said, you know, I really want to set the record straight about some things. And everyone's expecting him to talk about what he'd seen. And he takes that opportunity to say, I am not a chicken farmer. It has been said that I am a chicken farmer. In fact, I am a plumber who happens to have some chickens. And so I love that this is his kind of like major stand he's taken against the press. He's perfectly fine with people talking about his alien encounter, but he will not be called a chicken farmer.
Now, people have a wide variety of stories. And you share a lot more of them in your book. And some of them are just flat out hoaxes. Some of them are people who clearly believe what they've seen, others who are following up to look at it. But you take some lessons about our sense of wonder in the world. What after spending this time actually hitting the streets and investigating these stories, what kind of things did you learn about our sense of wonder?
You know, that's a great question. And certainly there are some larger findings about kind of the more scientific approach to why we see what we see, confirmation bias, psychological elements, pattern seeking things in the brain. But in our hearts, I think there's something happening too. You know, a long time ago, my students who were just fed up with me for asking them to write these persuasive essays said, well, we want you to persuade us of something. And I said, all right, well, what should I persuade you of? And they said, prove the existence of Bigfoot. And this was a huge challenge, you know, and I eventually was able to kind of rhetorically make some kind of argument that Bigfoot may not exist. So kind of doing some wiggle maneuvering there. But along the way, I realized that it's just a lot more fun to live in a world where we don't know everything. And you can kind of make an argument for a possibility, even of a creature like Bigfoot. In 2008, we thought there were only 50,000 lowland gorillas anywhere in the world. And just 50 miles off the nearest road in Africa, we found 125,000 more of them. So you hear stuff like that and you think maybe there is a Bigfoot or two out there, and it's worth wondering about, if nothing else.
You also, at the outset, said you were thinking about what we think about truth and lies and fake news. Did you learn anything in this process about those topics?
You know, I learned a lot, and it's hard to summarize. So much depends on the individual and also kind of the litmus test of what we see as our truth. But one thing I learned kind of more broadly is about folks in these small towns who did something really smart, especially in places like Rhinelander, who have their Hodag, or a place called Cherubusco, who has its giant turtle in Indiana. These people did something great, which was they embraced their strange. Rather than kind of shy away from their stories, they just embraced it fully. Now you can't go to Rhinelander without seeing the Hodag on every street corner, you know. And as a result, the town has more economic power, more cultural cachet. It really supports these small towns in a beautiful way. And to think all of this is because of a story of a creature that never even existed. It's just a lovely story about humanity and our ability to stretch the truth in playful ways, but also to be mindful of the ways we can also stretch truth in dangerous ways as well.
You mentioned the risks of people in professional settings tackling these topics. When you show up at a department meeting this fall, do you get any weird looks from your English professor colleagues that you were out hunting the Hodag?
You know, we just got done with the meeting about an hour ago, and I was expecting a few more looks. But you know what? I'm very fortunate to have wonderful colleagues. We all support each other pretty well. So maybe I'll just take them along for the next hunt.
Now, having gotten a taste for this, are you going to go back out legend hunting, or are you back in the armchair as far as this topic is concerned?
I'm in the armchair for the moment, but there's always more wonder out there to seek. And so I'm always looking for that next great story and hopefully to burn that tire rubber to find the next wonderful story.
BJ, thanks a lot for sharing these stories with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's BJ Hollers, Associate Professor of English at UW-Eau Claire. He talked with us about his new book, Midwestern Strange, Hunting Monsters, Martians, and the Weird in Flyover Country. Coming up, we'll talk about the media's relationship with the courts after three recent rulings that have some press advocates worried. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to a state lawmaker at the center of a debate over accessibility in the state legislature and why that issue has been attached to rules changes, making it easier for lawmakers to try to override the governor's vetoes. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, some First Amendment advocates say they're concerned about a series of recent court rulings and lawsuits challenging news outlets. Some of the big cases involve national media organizations like NPR, The New York Times, and Fox News. And the people bringing the lawsuits are challenging the reporting from those outlets, saying it was defamatory or that stories caused emotional distress. The judges overseeing the cases have allowed them to continue. Our next guest says it's fair to ask if this signals a change in how the courts see the media. Jane Curley is a professor of media ethics and law at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. She's also former executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. Jane, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, up till these recent cases, what was kind of the state of the art when it came to the press being protected from lawsuits over things they may have gotten wrong?
Well, since 1964, when the Supreme Court recognized in a case called New York Times versus Sullivan that public figures, public officials, had a very high burden of proof in order to prevail in a libel case, it's been really difficult for public figures and public officials to win, to even bring the case. And as you said in your opening comments, one of the things that has happened recently is that judges have seemed to be more willing to allow these cases to go past the first hurdle, to survive motions to dismiss or motions for summary judgment and go to trial. That's a big change because after Sullivan and its progeny, cases that followed on from it, most litigants parents were not successful in taking the case beyond an initial stage, which meant that they never went to trial. Now, in the cases that you enumerated, the courts are saying, yeah, you can go ahead and go to trial. And the risk there for news organizations is in this current climate where so many people are hostile to the press, that means that they're going to basically be at the mercy of juries who may be angry at that particular news outlet or may be angry at the media in general and could show that anger in the kind of judgment they render.
What would the bar have been under that Sullivan decision? If I'm a public figure and I'm trying to sue an outlet for libel, what would I have to establish for it to stand up in court up till these recent cases?
Well, it was a standard called actual malice, which a lot of people think means that the news outlet hated you or something, but that's not what the standard is. It's a legal term of art, and what it means is that the news outlet knew that what it published was false. In other words, that they fabricated it. We might think of it as genuine fake news. Or that they acted recklessly and published the material really without caring whether it was true or false. In other words, they didn't do what a responsible journalist would do to try to verify the accuracy of what they were reporting.
Now, when I look at tabloids as I'm buying groceries, it seems like a lot of headlines would meet that standard of proof. Why don't we see big lawsuits against them more often?
Well, the short answer to that is that those tabloids have very good lawyers who are quite adept at looking at the copy before it is published. They know exactly how far they can go and no further. I think it's interesting that so many of the cases we're talking about right now actually involve what most of us, I think, would think of as mainstream media, media that in general have very good reputations for good quality reporting and for correcting errors when they make them. That's not what we usually think of in the context of the tabloids. I remember years ago there was a case against one of the tabloids where basically, they won the case because they successfully argued that nobody believed what they reported anyway.
Talking to Jane Kartley from the University of Minnesota, looking at some court challenges that have First Amendment advocates worried about the press. Let's look at some of these cases now, Jane. One is the New York Times being charged by Sarah Palin, sued by Sarah Palin. Can you remind us what this one's about?
Yes, I'm sure many of us remember when Representative Gabby Giffords was shot in a rampage in Arizona. The Times had done a story later on down the line. Actually, it was an editorial commenting on gun violence in general and had inaccurately said that what had occurred in Arizona was related to something that Sarah Palin's PAC had published. Basically, that they had a graphic that supposedly showed gun or rifle crosshairs over a picture of Gabrielle Giffords, and in fact, her PAC had not done that. And so what was very unusual about this case was the federal district court had a very lengthy hearing prior to any of the decisions about whether they were going to dismiss the case or not, bringing in the guy who was the editorial page editor, a guy named James Bennett, and basically interrogated him about what he had done. The Court of Appeals panel said that ultimately he had not made a sufficient case, that he had made the error in good faith, and that the case could go forward to trial.
And it's important to note that the case has not been decided. The significant difference here is that it has gone to trial where often in the past it might not have. Is that right?
That's exactly it. I mean, it's also very interesting that the court in New York decided to have this initial hearing, which was fairly lengthy and I would say quite intrusive into sort of the mindset of what the news organization had done. And I think we can't discount the fact that having to mount a defense in that kind of hearing is expensive, it's time-consuming, it deflects journalists from their real work. So even if ultimately they win, the threat of something like this can have an impact on the kind of choices you make about the kind of journalism you'll do.
And one concern is, okay, if you're talking a national news organization, they may also have good lawyers and maybe fairly deep pockets. But for, say, a regional news outlet or a city news outlet, we know times are not so great for them. Is there a fear that if lawsuits go ahead more often, it could put these out of business since they can't afford to even mount a successful case?
In, In fact, that's already happened in a couple of instances. There was a case many years ago involving a newspaper in Belleville, Illinois, that was bankrupted over something that it actually never even published in their newspaper. It was in basically an internal memo that got out. This is a genuine concern today because even news organizations that we think of as longstanding and fairly wealthy cannot just idly take on the threat of a huge libel defense. As I said, even if they win and or there's not a huge judgment against them, it's still very expensive to defend themselves in cases like this. And under the American system, it's unlikely that they would be able to recover attorney's fees and costs even if they win.
There was a law or regulation called the SLAPP. I think it's strategic lawsuits against public participation. I don't know if I have that exactly right. But the idea is, all right, we're going to limit lawsuits that are made, in effect, just to bankrupt the target of the lawsuit, whatever the details of the case. Has that been a factor in past press lawsuit efforts?
It's interesting because the anti-SLAPP laws originally were designed to protect what was called public participation. And so it really wasn't aimed at news organizations. It was more for activists or even just citizens who would like stand up in a meeting and denounce somebody in government or a big corporation or something like that. And of course, those people would have much more limited resources. But after a few years, in most states, the courts that have had a chance to look at the SLAPP law, have said no reason why this can't apply to news organizations. So at least in some jurisdictions, we've actually got rulings that affirmatively say these laws can protect reporters from nuisance lawsuits or suits that are really designed, as you said, to bankrupt their news organization.
We're talking to Jane Kirtley, professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota, about three recent court rulings that are causing some concern for First Amendment watchers in lawsuits targeting big media outlets. We'll check out a couple more stories about NPR News and Fox News coming up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of all this? Should it be easier for someone to sue a media outlet, or should there be continue to be a high bar to protect press freedom? It doesn't matter if it's a public figure, an elected official, say, at the center of the question. And what questions do you have about all this stuff works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation about the courts and their relationship with the press. Jane Kirtley is with us from the University of Minnesota, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the courts letting some lawsuits against the media move forward? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go to our callers, Jan, I want to check out the other two cases. They're all kind of connected to a related issue. This next one is NPR and an investment advisor from Texas over NPR's reporting on Seth Rich. So we'll note here we are an NPR affiliate. It's a little complicated what's going on here.
Well, I mean, the most, I think, the gist of it is that Rod Wheeler basically is suing NPR because he claims that they inaccurately reported on some public legal filings in connection with this investigation into the death of Seth Rich. What the judge said was that the NPR report, although it was based on the public legal filings, basically implied that Wheeler had committed some kind of wrongdoings. And this is, and also implied basically that he had done something wrong. This is a significant ruling, in my opinion, even though, as you have said before, it's not the final ruling in the case. And it reflects what's going on in a number of places, including right now in Minnesota, where the courts are looking at what we call the fair report privilege, which is the right to accurately report without fear of being sued the contents of official documents like court filings. And I'm very concerned about this because this has been an extremely important protection, not just for the press, but for the public, because I think we have a right to know what government is up to, what they're saying in their reports, what's being filed in court filings. And this case does raise the question of whether, even if you accurately report what's there, you might be vulnerable to a lawsuit like this one.
And the person involved, Ed Butowski, he had funded some of these investigations. Is there some question over whether he constitutes a public figure for his participation
yes.
in this?
That's the other piece of this case that is concerning. Courts have obviously taken different approaches in defining who is a public figure and who is not. The original New York Times versus Sullivan case dealt with a public official, but later cases expanded that to include public figures. Some people are quite happy to say, yes, I'm a public figure, but of course if you do that, that means you have to prove actual malice. So many people fight very hard not to be classified as a public figure. I personally think that he would fall under the category of a public figure, but the tricky part is that sometimes you can argue that if you're only public because of the false and defamatory information that was published about you, that doesn't make you a public figure for the purposes of actual malice.
And then the third case you were watching involves Fox News and the family of Seth Rich. Walk us through this one.
Well, this is one where after the whole Seth Rich theory started being floated, Fox basically, allegedly, according to the parents of Seth Rich, conspired with Mr. Batowski in order to concoct and publish false reports about the dealings that the son had with WikiLeaks, because the idea of this particular conspiracy theory is that he was one of the sources of the Democratic National Committee emails that found their way to WikiLeaks. Essentially, what the family is arguing is that they conspired to make up fake news. And the judges in this case, in a circuit that's usually quite protective of the news media, said that it was at least plausible that this had happened. And so a jury would ultimately have to be the finders of fact to decide whether it did or not.
Talking to Jane Curley, professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota, looking at some cases involving the media, cases moving ahead in the courts where they might not have just a few years ago. Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dave is with us in Menominee. Dave, hi.
Hello.
What do you think?
Well, I think the media should be 100% the people in that do the media, reporters. They better make sure they get things 100% accurate, because look what's going on in this country right now. What happened to this Russian trying to interfere with our election when they found out that wasn't going to go nowhere? It took a year and a half and $20 million. Now we're right back in it again with this whistleblower. And is this really happened, or is this something they made up again? I mean, this is stuff like this has to end. It has to end, because look at what it's doing to this country.
Dave, thanks for the call. Of course, Russia did interfere with our election. That was the conclusion of the Mueller report, and most intelligence agencies. The whistleblower report does appear to actually exist. But Jane, to his point that he wants to see the media make sure they get everything right, how liable is the media when they just make a mistake?
Well, I mean, here's the important thing. The news media, whoever we're talking about, whether it's Fox News, CNN, NPR, whatever, they publish, you know, thousands if not millions of facts in any given year. And the odds that they'll get some of them wrong are incredibly high. No matter how careful you are, you can mess up. It is, you know, professional journalists just hate it when they make mistakes. And the thing that tells you, I think, that they're acting professionally is if they move as promptly as they can to correct those mistakes. I know we'd like to have infallibility in our public institutions as well as in the media, but that's really not realistic. So for me, the test is, did they act as you know, responsibly as they could in publishing the information and collecting the data, and do they correct it when they make a mistake? And again, this goes to the actual malice standard, because if you were not acting recklessly, if you were not deliberately publishing a falsehood, then the likelihood is that you're going to be protected. You know, President Trump has talked about opening up the libel laws because he thinks that the current standards provide too much protection to the press. But as the Supreme Court said back in 1964, we have to be able to allow journalists to make errors in good faith, because otherwise they'll censor themselves and the public will get less information.
Let's talk about who the media protections apply to. I know Alex Jones and his website and various media operations have been sued in part due to claims he's made about the Sandy Hook shooting and others. Is he a media outlet in terms of the legal protections?
That's such a great question, because the interesting thing is that the Supreme Court has never in any of its court opinions actually defined who the press is. And of course, 1964, that's what we talked about. We didn't talk about the media, it was the press. And I think the reason is that for many, many years, we didn't have to, because you basically looked at what people were doing. Were they gathering information to disseminate to the public? And if they were, then they fell under the banner of the news media or the press. We've never licensed news organizations in this country. I mean, yes, television stations get FCC licensing, but individual journalists do not. And that's viewed as something that would actually violate the First Amendment if we tried to do it. The problem now is that anybody who has access to the internet or to social media, digital media, can be engaging in things that look like journalism. And so I think it is becoming more complicated to answer that question, but to answer your specific question, I would say yes, he would be subject to the same protections that the New York Times would be.
Now, talk about libel laws. I understand that in some countries, including the UK, the things are very different. The standards for libel are very different. How do they compare, and what effect do you see that having on the media?
Well, they are different, and of course, as more and more American companies are really publishing literally over the all over the world, they have to pay attention to this. Basically, I would say that in many other countries, they default more to the idea that we have people have a right to protect their reputations. And it's not that we don't have that right here. It's just that when it's balanced against the First Amendment protections of the press, which, again, the public will benefit from, that oftentimes, unless it's a deliberate attempt to fabricate, make something up, or to act really recklessly, we have to protect the journalist's right to publish in order to protect the public right. That really isn't the view in many other countries. And in fact, because it's so different elsewhere, Congress passed a law some years ago called the Speech Act, which basically says that if you get a libel judgment in another country that has a law that's less protective than the law here, you can't enforce that judgment in the United States. You can't come into court here and make them pay, because it would violate the First Amendment interests that again, we all benefit from.
Do you see other cases like that one, or other instances that point in the other direction from the cases we've been talking about, that point toward stronger protections for the press?
Well, I would say not so much stronger protections, but that we're maintaining the status quo. Again, I think the Speech Act that I just mentioned is a great example of how even Congress was ready to say it's important to protect freedom of the press. And there have been several other cases. Even somebody like BuzzFeed has been successful in fending off a lawsuit that was brought by a Russian entrepreneur who said he was defamed. And there have been several other very strong pro-press rulings that have come out of the Sixth Circuit, for example, in Cincinnati. And, I guess I would say the sky is not falling at this point, but I think there are some cracks in the ceiling, in the sense that I think judges are becoming a little more skeptical of the idea that journalists are operating in good faith and that they make their mistakes in good faith. I think this endless drumbeat of fake news is having an effect. And while, there may be people out there that are deliberately publishing things they know aren't true with the intent to deceive, I don't think that applies to mainstream media in this country.
In our last minute or so, how do you think the mainstream media can respond?
Well, I think we just got to do a better job, obviously, of doing our work, being truthful, accurate, and correcting mistakes when we make them, but also educating the public and reminding them how important a free press really is. It's the cornerstone of our republic, of our democracy, however you want to define it. And without it, we really are hobbled in the sense of trying to hold government accountable.
Jane, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That's Jane Kirtley, media ethics and law professor from the University of Minnesota. She's with us today to talk about recent libel or defamation lawsuits involving the media that she says could signal a change in the way the courts see the press and its First Amendment protections. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, China's vast marketplace sometimes gives the country influence over decisions in American culture, in movies, video games, and most recently in the world of sports. We'll look at long-running efforts to appeal to the billion-plus market and how it affects what we see and hear, even here in the United States. It can be a four-letter word at the workplace, especially for women: nice. Our guest says women are held back by expectations that there'll be a certain kind of polite at work, and she has lots of advice to help change things. Plus, we'll hike the Ice Age Trail with a Wisconsin photographer who's on a 1,200-mile quest to share unique images of small towns along the way. That, plus we'll take a look at some of the top news stories of the day and check in on the latest in the impeachment inquiry in Congress. Lots of developments, probably more to come over the weekend. That's all coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Monday at 6, Kate and her guests take us to the theater for a look at the year-end movies, the big hits so far, and the films to watch out for in the fall and over the holidays. That's Monday at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next is news for NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, if you really want to wow your dinner guests, don't overlook the side dishes. Our guest from America's Test Kitchen has tips and a few recipes to help elevate our meals to the next level. Get started now. Find some recipes at wpr.org/foodfriday. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.